Chapter 11. A Breath of Nonsense. And if Subhuti, a woman or man, should renounce in the morning all their belongings as many times as there are grains of sand in the river Ganges, and if they should do likewise at noon and in the evening, and if in this way they should renounce all their belongings for many hundreds of thousands of millions of milliards of aeons, and someone else, on hearing this discourse on Dharma, would not reject it, then the latter would, on the strength of that, beget a greater heap of merit, immeasurable and incalculable. As we have seen, the temptation to reject this teaching is so great because it is so threatening, and the merit coming from resisting that temptation is commensurably great. Not rejecting it is tantamount to accepting it, or at least being open to it. There is another reason, however, for rejecting the Diamond Sutra, a reason which is perhaps closer to home for most of us. The gravamen of our resistance to it is likely to be that it hardly seems relevant or useful to our predicament. We can answer this charge in the language of the perfection of wisdom itself. Its usefulness is in its uselessness. It is relevant because it is so irrelevant. As seriously practicing Buddhists, we do need to be able to relate traditional teachings to our own personal experience. We need to work out how the Dharma bears upon our own lives, how it applies to the world we live in, and how to interpret ancient texts so as to be of practical and immediate concern to the situation in which we find ourselves. But on another level, we should not be over-concerned with what is relevant to me, interesting to me, applicable to my situation in the West. It is all very well to expect Buddhism to be meaningful to where we are, here and now, but where is here and when is now? Is our conditioned existence all we have? In the end, there needs also to be some element of the Dharma which is not relevant to our spiritual development at all. When it comes to transcending conditioned existence, the last thing we need is something useful. In fact, it takes something quite irrelevant to transcend conditions, and then the pointless becomes the most relevant thing of all. So in the Diamond Sutra, we are still concerned with the Dharma, but we are not concerned with any of the things that we usually think of as constituting the Dharma, the things that we settle down and feel comfortable with. We are taking a rest from looking at ethics or meditation or impermanence. Instead, we are getting a breath of nonsense, a touch of Lewis Carroll or Edward Lear, without suggesting by this analogy that Alice in Wonderland is some kind of Zen text, of course. The perfection of wisdom is like salt. An exclusive diet of it probably wouldn't do you much good, but you need a pinch of it in your spiritual diet all the time. It gives a little flavour, the flavour of irrelevance. Otherwise, if it all becomes too relevant, well, you take it all too seriously. You think too much in terms of yourself as you are now. It's refreshing to have something which, in a way, you understand, but which, in another way, you don't understand at all. What we have in the Diamond Sutra is a comprehensible but irrelevant meaning, with a further significance or purport that is relevant but is not comprehensible. It is not difficult to get at the meaning of the sentences, but to get at what I am calling the purport, the direction in which the words are pointing above and beyond the verbal meaning, is much more difficult. It may also sometimes be difficult to explain the connection between the meaning and the purport. What we may be sure of is that we can only get at the purport by constantly bearing the meaning in mind. One way to do this is to recite the words constantly, as one does in some visualization practices, repeating certain short verses over and over again. If we repeat the comprehensible but irrelevant words often enough, as monks have been doing for hundreds of years in the monasteries of Japan and the lamaseries of Tibet, something of the purport will begin to dawn on us. The Those who will take up this discourse on Dharma, bear it in mind, recite, study, and illuminate it in full detail for others. The Tathagata has known them with his Buddha cognition. The Tathagata has seen them with his Buddha eye. The Tathagata has fully known them. All these beings, Subhuti, will be blessed with an immeasurable heap of merit. They will be blessed with a heap of merit unthinkable, incomparable, measureless, and illimitable. All these beings, Subhuti, will carry along an equal share of enlightenment. This cake model of enlightenment, in the English at least, seems odd, not to say clumsy. The point being made is that all these beings will have much the same spiritual status. They will all partake equally in enlightenment, you might say. Quote, those who will take up this discourse on the Dharma, bear it in mind, recite, study, and illuminate it in full detail for others, unquote, will basically have a lot in common. Quite a reasonable inference. And why? Because it is not possible, Subhuti, that this discourse on Dharma could be heard by beings of inferior resolve, nor by such as have a self in view, a being, a soul, or a person. Nor can beings who have not taken the pledge of Bodhi beings either hear this discourse on Dharma, or take it up, bear it in mind, recite or study it. That cannot be. We know by now that the word because is likely to signal an inconsequential hop in the argument, and so it proves here. The reason is no reason at all. But the sutra evidently means this surprising assertion to be taken literally. If you hear the sutra, recite it or study it, you have to infer that you must have taken the bodhisattva vow. It is not saying that someone who does not have some sort of spiritual resolve will not understand the discourse. It is saying that such a person will not even hear it. If you have full faith in the sutra, you have to conclude that the mere fact that you are able to hear it in this life means that you must have taken the bodhisattva vow in a previous life. Well, is this idea so difficult to take seriously? Why should certain people be reading and studying a text that apparently makes no sense at all? It is by no means a bestseller. Konza's definitive translation has not, to my knowledge, set the publishing world alight. So how is it that we should come to be engaged with such a baffling and bewildering work as this? How is it that some people do take to certain things so very readily, like the proverbial duck to water? They just plunge in, as though whatever it is were already quite familiar to them. They are in their element. And how often have we come across a book, apparently by accident, at just the time we needed it, as though there was some kind of law of magnetic attraction working on some unseen plane? I'm not suggesting a sort of linear causality in operation here, but something more like a web of interrelationships spanning, I will not say transcending, both time and space. You touch one part of the web, and there is a response from another corresponding part. In this way, we may start to wonder if we might not have some kind of mysterious affinity with this perfection of wisdom teaching that goes back to a previous life. Perhaps we are tempted to believe that we are coming back to something that we have known before, and taking up the threads once again. We may even decide that the temptation not to believe that this may be so is the one to be examined. At the bottom of all this is the general principle that you are drawn to a teaching when you are ready for it. It is as though the teaching is moving toward you at the same time that you are moving towards it. It is perhaps an encouraging thought, and perhaps also a sobering one, that merely coming into contact with the teachings of the perfection of wisdom means that you have a certain spiritual capacity, that the ground has been prepared to some extent. If you have got as far as taking up the Diamond Sutra, you have actually come a very long way. This kind of optimistic perspective on one's spiritual condition is an unfamiliar one for anyone brought up within the Christian tradition of original sin. The taint of Adam's fall may be purified by baptism, but how long does that state of purity last? Does it survive the first time the baby clutches its little fists or gives mother a nasty look? Not according to St. Augustine. It has surprised me in the past how many people brought up as Christians, whether Protestant or Catholic, have appeared to know very little about actual Christian teaching. Instead, they just seem to have absorbed a sort of gloomy presence. The Mahayana perspective is simply more encouraging, if also more demanding, inasmuch as we have that much more to live up to. There is no excuse for apathy or unskillful mental states, and no excuse for complacency either. The responsibility for our condition is our own, and the means of improving it are also in our own hands. This less oppressive atmosphere needs a bit of getting used to. We probably need to remind ourselves to take a few deep breaths of it from time to time. Buddhism is not saying that we definitely have exalted spiritual antecedents, but only that we cannot rule out the possibility. If we find ourselves, for whatever reason, studying the perfection of wisdom, this must be accounted a very propitious circumstance indeed. We are not doing too badly at all with our lives. We probably have more merit working for us than we think. If you do still feel like a miserable sinner, well, perhaps you are just a backsliding bodhisattva, an arhat on the skid, a down-at-heel incarnate lama. Perhaps your present incarnation is just a hiccup in an otherwise rather distinguished spiritual progression. This particular world system is supposed to be a tough one, where the influence of Mara is dominant, and attachments are very strong. So why not be optimistic? Taking up the Diamond Sutra, you are perhaps simply back where you belong. Of course, there are people who would feel quite uneasy if they were told that they had taken the Bodhisattva vow, and who would contemplate the prospect of becoming a Buddha with a certain amount of dismay. This is certainly the conclusion of the Saddhamma Pundarika, in which the Bodhisattva, who goes about telling people that they are all due for Buddhahood, fails to meet with a very favourable response. I am also reminded of a passage from a Chinese opera translated by Lin Yutang, a long declamatory song from a young girl who is running away from a nunnery, and who says, among some other rather strong things, that she does not want to be a nun, indeed she does not want to be a Buddha, and she is not going to be a Buddha. She is going to run down the hill away from the nunnery and find herself a handsome young lover. And no, she is not going to be a Buddha. On the other hand, it was once said of my friend and teacher, Dada Rinpoche, that although he did not at first feel like an incarnate bodhisattva, he believed those who had told him that this was what he was, and simply acted accordingly. In the same way, if having come in contact with the Diamond Sutra convinces you that you have taken the bodhisattva vow, then there is just the simple matter of acting as if you had. It makes everything terrifyingly simple. You know who you are, so you know exactly what you have to do.